Okay, so now this session is on sale now, Neoliberalism and the Commodification of Feminism. Each speaker will have half an hour, as the previous session, and then we have a discussant, and the panel will take questions from the discussant, and then we'll open it up for general discussion. So our first speaker is Catherine Rottenberg from Goldsmiths, and she's talking on neoliberal feminist paradoxes.
So I'm just going to begin by thanking Maria and the organizers. Amazing organizational skills, and really thank you for making this possible. Not an easy task, given all the complications beforehand, and this doesn't count for my 32 minutes. And I also want to thank the panelists before. I'm really, really humbled to be here, and thank you so much. So, and this is part of the provocation, and my work is meant to be a kind of provocation, and in a sense, it goes very well afterwards, after the first panel. And I also apologize because I am going to read, which is unfortunate, but I can't do it any other way. So, let us go to Ivanka Trump. Okay. When Ivanka Trump's How to Succeed guide, Women Who Work, was released in May 2017, it generated a flurry of angry reviews in the mainstream media. Many commentators excoriated the book, claiming that this new having it all manifesto was nothing more than artless jargon, which could just as easily have been found when Googling inspirational quotes. And yet, notwithstanding this widespread criticism, Women Who Work has become a New York Times bestseller and continues to sell extremely well. While it is certainly clear that, it's certainly true that Women Who Work is littered with decontextualized and cliches and unabashedly endorses the Ivanka lifestyle brand, what I want to argue today is that Trump's manifesto warrants serious analysis because it captures and reproduces a key contemporary neoliberal expectation that individuals, and particularly women, should never cease working on themselves in order to enhance their value as human capital. However, before I regale you with my analysis of Ivanka Trump's book, I'd like to provide a thumbnail sketch of my arguments with respect to neoliberal feminism and highlight two important factors that I believe need to be taken into consideration when speaking about the mutual entanglement of feminism and neoliberalism. And I hope by doing this I can contextualize my analysis or my reading of Women Who Work. So the first factor is the recent surge in feminist discourse in popular and mainstream venues in both the US and in the UK. The F word is literally everywhere these days. From mainstream print media to popular television shows through New York Times best-selling books like Lean In, and let's not forget our prime minister. Second, this mainstreaming and popularization has often gone hand in hand with defanging feminism, and particularly mainstream liberal feminism, of its oppositional potential. As many scholars have already demonstrated, more than simply being popularized, feminist themes have increasingly dovetailed and indeed converged with dominant ideologies and conservative forces across the globe. Now, again, this is not to say, and I think the first panel was really important in stressing, that there has not always been feminist resistance on the ground or that all feminist discourse has been co-opted. That is not what I'm saying. But in my work, and I think this is, again, a different in emphasis and sort of the questions that are motivating us, what I'm fascinated by and also disturbed by is the way in which feminism has been enfolded into mainstream common sense in the U.S. over the past half decade and the ways in which it's been enfolded, and how identifying as a feminist has become a source of social and cultural capital and a mark of pride for an increasing number of highly visible and powerful women of all political stripes in the US. So in my research, I posit that we have witnessed the emergence of a new variant of feminism in the US, which I also claim revolves centrally around the notion of a happy work-family balance. So what I suggest is that balance has been incorporated into the social imagination as a cultural good, not only as a cultural good, but as actually helping to engender a new model of emancipated womanhood, a professional woman able to balance a successful career with a satisfying family life. A happy work-family balance, in other words, is currently being represented as a progressive feminist ideal. This new feminist ideal must not only be understood as helping to shape women's desires and behavior, but also as producing a feminist subject informed through and through by a market metrics. And this is, in short, what I call neoliberal feminism. This is a feminism that has been unmoored from key terms such as equality, justice, and emancipation and autonomy, or disavowing the socioeconomic and cultural structure shaping our lives. Neoliberal feminism creates a feminist subject who accepts full responsibility for her own well-being and self-care, which are predicated on crafting a felicitous work-family balance, which is itself based on a cost-benefit calculus. So as might already be clear, and Sara spoke a little bit about Wendy Brown, I'm following political theorists such as Michelle Phair and Wendy Brown. I understand neoliberalism as, not merely as an economic system or a set of policies that facilitate intensified privatization and deregulation, but as a dominant political rationality or a normative form of reason that moves to and from the management of the state to the inner workings of the subject, recasting individuals as entrepreneurial and capital-enhancing agents. So neoliberal rationality extends a specific formulation of economic values, practices, and metrics to every dimension of human life, recasting and transforming human subjects into human capital. Now, in addition, and this is the provocation, I suggest that neoliberalism may actually need feminism to resolve, at least temporarily, one of its internal tensions in relation to gender. So if we think about neoliberalism as an economic order, neoliberalism relies on reproduction and care work in order to reproduce and maintain human capital. Yet as a political rationality, and in contrast to liberalism, neoliberalism has no lexicon that can recognize, let alone value, reproduction and care work. Everything is reduced to market metrics, even our political imagination. Different registers, political, economic, social, and affective, collapse under neoliberalism, and all forms of valuation transpire through a cost-benefit metrics. So the disappearance of a political lexicon is not only due to human subjects being increasingly converted into generic human capital, where gender is disavowed, but also because the division of the public-private spheres informing liberal thought and the traditional sexual division of labor is being eroded through the conversion of everything into capital and the infiltration of a market rationality into all spheres of life, including the most private ones. So my main argument, in short, is that neoliberal feminism has been operating as a kind of pushback to the total conversion of educated and upwardly mobile women into generic human capital. By paradoxically and counterintuitively maintaining reproduction as part of middle-class or so-called aspirational women's normative trajectory and positing balance as its normative frame and ultimate ideal, neoliberal feminism helps to both maintain a discourse of reproduction and care work while ensuring that all responsibility for these forms of labor, but not necessarily all of the labor itself, and I'll get to that in a second, falls squarely on the shoulder of aspirational women. So in this way, it solves its own constitutive tension, again, the quandary of reproduction and care work, at least temporarily. Indeed, neoliberal feminism produces and maintains a distinctive and affective lexiconic register of reproduction and care work within neoliberalism, even as neoliberal rationality collapses the private-public divide. And I'll try and unpack that a little bit more as I go through Trump's text. Furthermore, as reproductive technology develops, a certain strata of women will likely be able to outsource reproduction and care work more and more. thus ensuring the re-entrenchment of the so-called aspirational subject as generic human capital on the one hand, and producing a whole other class of women who are conceived as not fully responsabilized and thus exploitable and thus disposable on the other. And given the reality that most often women of color, poor and immigrant women serve as the unacknowledged care workers who enable professional women to strive towards balance in their lives, neoliberal feminism helps to reproduce and legitimize the exploitation of these other female subjects while simultaneously and crucially disarticulating the very vocabulary with which to address these inequalities. So in this way, neoliberal feminism not only forsakes the majority of women by splitting female subjecthood, but it also facilitates the creation of new and intensified forms of racialized and class stratified gender exploitation, which increasingly constitutes the increasingly invisible infrastructure of our new neoliberal order. So with this as background, now I'm gonna move on to Ivanka Trump and women who work. So, and I did that pretty fast, so I hope I'm doing okay in terms of that. Okay. So Trump's main message, and the one that serves as her repetitive mantra, is that women should work on all facets of their life. Their, quote, career, relationship, family, friendships, hobbies, and passions, end quote. This reminds me of what Kalpana was talking about in terms of leisure time. The address is directed, not surprisingly, towards, again, aspirational women who are incited to achieve their best self, both professionally and personally. Success is defined as facing obstacles with resilience, initiative, and creativity, while one's ability to thrive is described as, quote, limited only by one's own hunger, drive, passion, and execution, end quote. According to Trump, then, empowerment and achievement involve individual women consciously choosing to create the life they desire and proactively crafting such a life through continuous labor and perseverance. So as I mentioned earlier, Women Who Work captures and reproduces a key contemporary and neoliberal expectation that individuals, and particularly women, should never cease working on themselves in order to enhance their value. So what I argue is that the manifesto deserves attention precisely for the way that it lays bare the intensive labor, affective and physical, that women are expected to invest in themselves in order to approximate the contemporary norm of female, and I will argue neoliberal feminist accomplishment. The ideal female subject is, however, not only conceived of as human capital, but a close examination of women who work also reveals how the self is produced as well as reproduces it, as well as produces itself as an individual firm or business enterprise, where all activities and practices are understood as investments that aim to appreciate the value of the self as firm. Trump's text, in other words, encourages women to consider themselves as a form of stock, where their normative role is to augment their market value. This entails incessant labor, particularly the modification of behavior, aspirations, and affective orientation, much like a corporation that alters its practices in an attempt to increase its stock value. The woman as stock framework, in effect, conjures the ultimate neoliberal subject, one shorn of any and all liberal trappings. So like all of these best-selling neoliberal feminist manifestos, Lean In, and I'll come to some others in a minute, Trump clearly states her conviction that working towards greater gender equality is of paramount importance, while explicitly acknowledging that gender parity has yet to be reached in the United States. In her introductory chapter, Trump declares that despite the progress and the many advances women have made since her mother's generation, quote, we've still got a long way to go, end quote. Moreover, she advocates for certain structural changes, such as paid maternity leave. These avowals, which can be understood as one of the signs marking the shift from a post-feminist moment to a feminist one, are, however, overlaid by a much more profound and general disavowal. Trump spends approximately one page, if that, of her 212-page book expounding on structural obstacles. One page, yeah. The overwhelming majority of the advice and instruction given by Trump to less famous and wealthy women revolves around the labor individual women are required to invest in themselves in order to achieve success. So women who work can be read as exposing the processes through which aspirational women are interpolated, addressed as potentially capital-enhancing subjects. Through a constant exhortation that women invest in and work on all domains of their lives, Trump reveals, performs, and helps to reproduce the conversion of women from ostensible autonomous rights-bearing liberal subjects who need to fight discrimination in order to gain access to the marketplace to sell their labor, into subjects who must work tirelessly on themselves in order to produce and cultivate themselves as human capital. Moreover, this human capital, she intimates, must be maintained continuously. Every aspect of the self becomes a site of speculation, intense scrutiny, and affective investment, a process whose objective is to increase and diversify the self's assets, to facilitate its appreciation, but just as importantly, to prevent its depreciation. So this totalizing approach of the self as human capital serves to facilitate the transformation of the self into a business enterprise while simultaneously helping to further unravel the public-private divide. It's therefore not only the economization, making everything into market metrics, of all domains of life under neoliberal rationality that collapses the liberal distinction between the private sphere of care and the public sphere of labor, rendering them interchangeable. But it is also neoliberalism's subjective apparatus that helps accelerate the eradication of this distinction. What does that mean? The neoliberal subject herself, recast as an individual firm, is compelled and encouraged to perceive every and all aspects of her life and self, including reproduction and care work, as requiring continuous capital investment, ultimately rendering the separation of the public-private unintelligible. In other words, as neoliberal rationality transforms more and more elements of society into enterprises informed by a business model with financialization at its heart, not only do all remaining public-private distinctions collapse, but the self itself becomes increasingly indistinguishable from any other kind of business enterprise, which ultimately undermines the very logic upholding the separation between the spheres. So Trump's manifesto can be said to reveal as enact a twofold collapsing of traditionally distinct realms, the public versus the private, as well as one's enterprise versus oneself. So following her prolonged introduction, Trump urges women to draft a personal mission statement, which she claims will pay certain, quote, dividends in the future by helping them to identify their passions and true north, end quote. This exercise, in other words, will help them maximize their influence later on. After identifying what their passions are, preferably in their 20s, women are subsequently encouraged to enter the business or professional world and to cultivate a wide array of capabilities, such as networking and negotiating deals. These capabilities are considered key for increasing the probability of creating a successful enterprise and, quote, making one's mark, end quote. Yet this is precisely the moment when the boundary between the self and business becomes blurred, since the advice to foster these abilities, networking, negotiating skills, is meant to enhance not only the business one works for, or in her case runs, but also, and perhaps most crucially, the self itself. This helps explain why Women Who Work repeatedly insist that it is important for women who have begun to make their mark professionally to create to-do charts, to, quote, prioritize their time so that they are always adding value, end quote. Planning well, which includes making endless lists about what women want to accomplish, from mission statements to everyday color-coded to-do lists, and I'm holding it, right, is central to ensuring that hard work will enhance value and yield the proper results. The self thus becomes, in the words of feminist theorist Angela McRoby, a kind of neoliberal spreadsheet, indistinguishable from a business when one calculates one's assets, one's losses, and what is more or less valuable in order to decide where more capital investment in the form of developing entrepreneurial skills, resources, or capacities is necessary. In Women Who Work, the self has indeed been unashamedly transformed into an enterprise, and as such, there is no longer any need to presuppose the separation of the private and the public spheres. So the reconfiguration and collapse of the private-public divide is perhaps most evident as Trump includes domains traditionally and historically excluded from the notion of, quote, boosting one's productivity and maximizing one's efficiency, end quote, in neoliberalism's calculative schema. Hobbies, friendships, and other intimate relationships that under liberalism were separate, at least conceptually, from a calculative matrix are now carefully remade into forms of investment and value management. While the book merely intimates that decisions about who one dates and marries should be part of this calculus, it explicitly encourages women to foster friendships and hobbies not as ends in themselves, in and of themselves, but instead as part of the self as business's capital-enhancing process. When discussing the importance of networking for women just starting out in their career, Trump urges these women to make one new strong bond each time they meet people at a party or conference. Of course, you could ask, you know, who can afford to attend these conferences in the first place? Certainly not women who are working double shifts, night shifts, or two or three jobs just to support themselves and or their families. Both the cultivation of intimacies as well as self-care and leisure activities are transposed in this way into business-like strategies, which also illustrates how neoliberal rationality and its subjective apparatus dissolves traditional forms of social ties and relations, even towards oneself. What we witness then is the economization of domains once closely associated with the non-market interests of the private sphere. But particularly striking is how affect, once again inextricably linked to the domestic realm, has been transformed into its own form of asset or capital, which now requires smart investment so as to increase the probability of dividends in the future. One's affective attachments are perceived as forms of capital to be cultivated and invested in order to enhance the value of the self's overall portfolio. Indeed, savvy self-investment and entrepreneurial strategies of self-care have become paramount. In this way, Trump's How to Succeed book provides readers with a clear, and I would say devastating, vision of a world in which all spheres of human life have become completely saturated, not only by a calculative reason, but also refigured by neoliberalism's moral imperative to appreciate, or at least maintain, one's own market value as the ultimate aim in life. So, on the one hand, Women Who Work clearly exposes many of the processes through which subjects are required to remake themselves into various credit-seeking assets, endlessly working on themselves in order to increase their worth. Trump lays out in some detail the various kinds of temporal, affective, aesthetic, physical investments that women must make in order to ensure that they can manage themselves successfully, precisely as capital-enhancing subjects. Taking care of ourselves and professional development are, Trump insists, things that, quote, we must prioritize so that we may become the best version of ourselves and achieve our goals, end quote. These activities are meant to maximize women's value. This text can therefore be said to encourage and further enact the conversion of so-called aspirational women into generic rather than gendered human capital. And in a sense, her text enacts the newest permutation of neoliberal feminism, and one may actually reveal the logical limits of this new variant. And this process is perhaps best exemplified in the refiguring of motherhood in managerial terms. Although Trump does pay tribute to norms of intensive and hands-on motherhood, she simultaneously provides various directives about how to better manage the caregiving role. She tells us that she writes lists for, quote, listen, connecting with each of her kids, putting real thoughts into ideas for producing memorable moments, end quote, she can create with them. Her approach to care work is calculative and reads more like ticking off the right boxes in order to demonstrate correct investment for eventual returns in the form of future memories. She also informs her readers that she makes sure to have concrete family goals, which then enable her to pencil in time with her family. So in Women Who Work, the realm of care is transmogrified into regulated, calculative, and carefully planned affective investment. The way in which reproductive and care work is presented here, namely in more managerial terms, thus undermines in interesting ways discourses of natural female nurturing instincts, also gestures to the further saturation of a market metrics into domains that have traditionally upheld the gender division of labor, further attenuating the link between women, or to be more precise, a certain strata of women and care work. As a result, the ideal female self who Trump presents potentially challenges traditional notions of sexual difference. But on the other hand, and crucially, the conversion of these aspirational women into generic human capital remains incomplete. And not merely because women are the ones deemed responsible for managing those to-do lists. Rather, Trump's normative trajectory still includes reproduction, while her ideal of female success remains a happy work-family balance, which is precisely why women who work should be considered a neoliberal feminist manifesto par excellence. Reproduction and care work continue to function as a kind of pushback to neoliberalism's conversion of aspiration women into generic subjects. Moreover, even as Trump extends a market metrics to all domains of women's life, thus contributing to the invisibilization of the gendered care infrastructure undergirding neoliberalism, in Trump's case through the outsourcing of this care to nannies and other domestic help mentioned, if at all, once in the entire book. She repeatedly insists that she greatly values her role as wife to Jared Kushner. So this insistence on wifehood aligns or realigns her with a certain traditional or a certain familial traditionalism, as Shani Orgad has argued in a different context, and it can also be understood to help buttress the pushback against a potential erasure of sexual difference. So in the larger project, I go into much more detail about the contradictory aspects of Trump's text, but I want to now just turn very, very briefly to the comparative aspect of this project in order to underscore that women who work can't be understood as an outlier. The criticism basically said that this is the criticism, we can't take it seriously, blah, 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 blah. But in fact, what she's saying is very, very similar to other manifestos and texts that have been published in the last couple of years. So Trump's overall message is uncannily similar to that of several other much more positively received texts, including the former Fox anchor woman Megyn Kelly's advice-oriented memoir, entitled "Settle for More," and the former Princeton dean and current CEO of the think tank New America, Anne Marie Slaughter's "Unfinished Business," which is in some ways a sequel to her widely commented upon article, "Why Women Still Can't Have It All," published in The Atlantic in 2012. So when reading Trump in conjunction with Kelly and Slaughter, three things emerge most strikingly. First, all three espouse that by now familiar notion of a happy work-family balance as their ideal of female accomplishment. Second, all three texts ultimately place the responsibility for social change on individual women's shoulders. And finally, each one reflects and reproduces a cultural and political landscape in which more and more domains of life are being reduced to and understood through an economic frame. So Trump and Kelly's agreement on so many key issues, particularly concerning the expediency of hard work and their New York complete disavowal of the structural obstacles facing women, is not particularly surprising, given their more similar conservative political alignments. But then where does Slaughter fit in? The self-identified liberal democratic feminist figure. As other scholars have pointed out, the final chapters of Unfinished Business, which lays out Slaughter's concrete proposals about how to, quote, complete the feminist revolution, not only read like a do-it-yourself manual, like a self-help manual, but her suggestions focus almost exclusively on women's individual responsibility as well. Quote, "It is up to you," she insists, "to start thinking now about what might happen later," end quote. Arguably the most revealing moment in Unfinished Business, and one that sheds the brightest and most frightening light on why there is so much overlap among these three women's texts, is when Slaughter queries how we should measure the human capital that we build through nurture and care. She states that while managing money may be difficult, so too is managing children. After all, they are both investments in certain kinds of capital. Clearly, invoking the language of human capital is itself significant, underscoring the way in which Unfinished Business is informed by neoliberalism. unfinished business. Actually, I didn't think about them until tonight. But it is the answer that Slaughter provides to her own question that I believe is even more significant. She maintains that valuing care as much as competition requires our ability to measure the true, quote, economic value of care for children and adults, end quote. What Slaughter seems to be saying here is that in order to arrive at the true value of care work, new economic indicators must be introduced into the reproductive and care sectors, ones that can more adequately evaluate proper compensation for such labor. Now, on the one hand, this is clearly a laudable objective, right? Since care work has been traditionally gone either unacknowledged or, if acknowledged, has gone vastly undervalued. On the other hand, the proffered solution to what Slaughter calls the care problem must be understood as part of the wider of the wider cultural landscape in which we are witnessing the conversion of everything into an economic frame. Slaughter's book, I would suggest, fully participates in this process while helping to eclipse other possible registers through which we might evaluate our work, actions, relations, and affective attachments. So despite their individual idiosyncrasies, it is, I believe, crucial to understand that these three books have all been forged within an increasingly dominant neoliberal environment, which collapses and refigures traditional distinctions between Democrat and Republican, private and public spheres, and oneself and one's enterprise. So by way of conclusion, I want to just very briefly return to some of my opening remarks, underscoring that neoliberal feminism in no way constitutes a threat to the powers that be. It effectively defangs feminism of its oppositional force by individualizing and responsibilizing women and by helping neoliberal rationality resolve one of its constitutive tensions by maintaining a distinctive lexicon of reproduction and care work. Simultaneously, the notion of a happy work-family balance as a feminist ideal has helped to render this variant of feminism palatable and legitimate, facilitating neoliberal feminism's widespread embrace and circulation within the Anglo-American mainstream cultural landscape. Indeed, precisely because neoliberal feminism incites individual women to, quote, internalize the revolution, end quote, and focus on themselves and their own aspirations, thus buttressing neoliberalism's hegemony, it can more easily be popularized, sold, and capitalized upon in the marketplace. However, this process of popularization may constitute a double-edged sword, since, as Susan Buck Morris has argued, power always produces its own vulnerability. In other words, what I'd like to suggest, instead of ending on a really depressing note, is that in addition to Father Trump's election and the reappearance of a shameless sexism in the public sphere, which has had its own galvanizing effect, movements like Me Too have been able to gain such widespread traction at this particular moment in history, at least in part, because feminism had already been embraced and rendered desirable by high-power corporate women like Sheryl Sandberg, Hollywood stars like Emma Watson, as well as music celebrities like Beyoncé, to name just a few. Thus, rather than ending on a pessimistic note, I'd like to suggest that by facilitating feminism widespread embrace, neoliberal feminism has also, and paradoxically, helped to pave the way for the resurgence of a more militant and mass feminist movement. And here I would give the examples of the Women's March and the International Women's Strike. So the urgent question again, and it goes back to the question that we heard this morning, is how can we sustain and broaden this feminist renaissance as counter-hegemonic, and thus as a threat to the powers that be, while rejecting the neoliberal feminist logic informing Ivanka Trump's Women Who Work.